The Education, Finance, and Economic Competitive Division will come to order. Today is Library Day. I brought my two favorite books. So I hope. And I know that libraries do other things than have books. But it's our greatest resource for books. And it's the greatest resource that people that can't afford to buy them. Do you know how much a book costs these days? Holy cow! I don't know how we do it, but maybe by the end of the hour, we will find out. Last year, there was for the first time in a long time, we put some new monies into libraries. I was kind of curious to see how the libraries would deal with that and what plans they had for their new money and money that they wish they had. Miss Keith, you represent libraries. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Elaine Keith for the record, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Library Association and the Minnesota Educational Media Organization. And I want to thank you for devoting the hearing today to libraries. When this committee was formed, my first thought was that this was really made for libraries. The way libraries cooperate across traditional institutional lines means that although we're all part of education, we often don't fit neatly and discreetly into the traditional categories of early childhood, K-12, and higher education. And let me give you some examples. Public libraries are funded in the K-12 budget, but they serve everyone from infants to senior citizens. Minitech and Minlink are library programs that are funded in the higher ed budget, and they do serve higher ed libraries, but they also provide services to K-12 schools and public libraries because we get more bang for our buck when we all work together. K-12 schools, public libraries, and higher education all share a high-speed telecommunications network called the Learning Network of Minnesota. You'll hear from our presenters today about how libraries work together across traditional lines, sometimes in surprising ways, and how Minnesota benefits from the tremendous level of cooperation among our different types of libraries. Last year, as the chair mentioned, the legislature increased funding for regional public libraries, multi-type libraries, and Minitech, and we're very grateful to you for that. These appropriations have not been increased in many years. Representative Murphy has asked our witnesses to talk today about how that funding is helping us to improve library services, and we're happy to do that. We do still have resource challenges, and our witnesses will also be talking about that. And with that, I'd like to turn the mic over to Mark Ranum.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Ranum.
Thank you, Representative Murphy and members of the committee. My name is Mark Ranum. I'm the director of the Regional Public Library System in the southwest corner of the state, serving 9 counties. You have a handout in front of you with the map of the 12 regional public library systems, and you can see Plum Creek Library System in the southwest. I'm here today to talk a little bit about the regional public library system, what they do currently, and what we plan to do with some of that additional money that was allocated by the legislature. Regional libraries have been around for 50 years, starting with 3 counties in east central Minnesota in 1959. And as a result of that partnership, other cities and counties around the state saw the effect and the positive nature of that partnership and started forming regional library systems based on state statutes that allowed that to happen. State money for library services is used to leverage local dollars. It's important to recognize that local dollars really run public libraries in the state of Minnesota. In my region, for example, we receive about $340,000 worth of state dollars in the Regional Library Basic System Support Grant, but over $3 million is spent on library services raised from local cities and county tax dollars, and that funding doesn't even include the amount of money spent on new buildings or construction of buildings, sometimes reaching into the millions and multi-millions of dollars. The state funds provide incentives for cities and counties to work together to share services and collections. Libraries have been doing that effectively, particularly since the early 1970s when resource sharing became a huge bonus in Minnesota for public library citizens, and we were able to offer delivery around the state of Minnesota. The state support provides cooperation among regions, so local libraries have a conduit through which to send materials, to get materials delivered locally, and then to get them returned. The biggest positive about local library service in Minnesota that the state funds is actually reciprocal borrowing, and that's where you can borrow a piece of material, a book on tape, a few books for your kids. No matter where you're at, if you're on vacation, you can step into a local public library, borrow materials, and then when you're back home, return them at your local library, knowing that they'll get returned through the statewide delivery system. Hundreds of thousands of items are moved around the state every year, and you'll be hearing a little bit more about that later on, I believe. So, Representative Murphy asked the question about what are the grants used for? Well, regional basic system support grants are used in a variety of ways around the state, depending on the region and depending on the local needs. However, there are a number of areas where we know library and library directors like me are going to be spending money, and library boards, which are run by citizens and local county and city representatives, to improve library services locally. One major area is delivery. There are library systems right now where they do 3-day-a-week delivery to all of their libraries. The state delivers materials to the central headquarters 5 days a week. We'd like to see that improved so the materials can get to people more quickly and that resources can be returned more quickly. Technology support is also a major issue. There are library systems right now where they can only afford to provide technology replacement for their computers, their public access computers, for example, for internet or word processing for people to walk in who don't have technology in their home. They can only afford to replace those every 6 years. Well, 6 years is a long time if you think about when you need to replace your computer. The new money will allow those libraries to now get on a 3-year replacement cycle, keeping their technology up to date. Obviously, more open hours are in demand. We know that people want to use libraries on weekends. We know that they want to use them in the evening. And many of these local libraries will benefit with more hours. They also will increase their own collections. They know from what people are borrowing from around the state, from other libraries, what their citizens need and what they're desiring in terms of more diversity of collections. And with diversity, it might mean the diversity of language collections to serve specific needs, but it may also just be more materials to serve growing populations of young people, of seniors. Baby boomers retiring is becoming a major issue for public libraries, and we're trying to provide services for them. So, the state funding that provides the basis for statewide delivery and cooperation and collaboration really provides services to every citizen in the state.
Thank you. Melanie Higgins from the St. Paul Library.
Hello, I'm Madam Chair and committee members. I'm actually Melanie Huggins.
Oh, excuse me.
That's okay.
I didn't wear my glasses.
That's okay.
Vanity.
I'm thrilled to be here just to share a few minutes with you about public libraries' role in early education, specifically early literacy. And I love to look at the click, clack, move, how's that type while I do it. It makes me feel right at home as a reformed children's librarian, now a library director in St. Paul. Public libraries across the country, and indeed in Minnesota, have played a unique role in getting children ready to read. And while librarians have always been champions of connecting children with good books, we now know, thanks to recent brain research, that more than we ever did before in the past about how children actually learn how to read. And we know it begins well before a child ever sets foot in kindergarten. Over the past 8 years, libraries across the country, led by libraries in Minnesota, actually, have worked with the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development to turn that brain research into best practices for libraries and develop training and tools for working with parents and children during those first critical years of development. And while we talk about the work of early literacy work of libraries, I just want to clarify that what we're talking about are those precursor skills that every child has to master before they are ready to read. This work is critically important to us in public libraries because, according to the Department of Education School Readiness Study conducted in the fall of 2006 here in Minnesota, almost half of all children entering kindergarten had not yet acquired the language and literacy skills expected for their age. In my city of St. Paul alone, 56% of those children assessed lacked the required level of language and literacy knowledge to be successful in school. and we know there's a direct correlation between income status and educational level of parents and the level of school readiness of kindergarten. So providing those books for free is critically important to those that don't have the means. While we know all this, the libraries in Minnesota have responded in beautiful ways. And the first thing is they put early literacy at the top of their must-do or to-do list. They do this in a couple of ways, and you'll see this all across the state. They disseminate information, whether it's through a website like we have here in St. Paul called Blast Off to Kindergarten, where we're partnering with the schools to let people know about it's a month-by-month access point to what skills you can be working on to get ready to read, to things that are happening in Princeton, like the Families Reading Every Day program, where it's really talking about parents reading and the importance of the parents as the role of first teacher. There are Lapsit baby programs, books and baby programs happening all over the state as well. We have early literacy spots. So we're actually using our physical facilities as training grounds for teachers. And one of some of the best comments that you hear when parents of all backgrounds, of all languages say, I didn't know that I had the ability to make this difference. And so you really know that you're making a difference when you're hearing parents admit that they had no idea before they participated in the library program that they were their child's first teacher. When we're doing this work, we are always balancing this with all of the other resource allocation challenges that we have and all the other things that are on our to-do list. We know that to be champions of early literacy, to be educators, to be disseminating information in ways and to be providing engaging learning environments, it takes well-educated staff. It takes access hours that are, as we heard earlier, that are open when parents can get there, when educators can get there. And it takes physical facilities that are inviting and engaging. And we can actually use our buildings to help educate better as well. So I hope you hear from my passion that this is something that is critically important. Early literacy development is critically important to the role and mission of public libraries. And we appreciate your continued support in making that happen.
Thank you, Ms. Huggins.
Mm-hmm.
Ann Walker. Ann Walker, Molly.
All those three names. My name is Ann Walker Smalley, and I'm the director of MetroNet. And MetroNet is one of seven multi-county, multi-type library cooperatives in the state of Minnesota. We are designed to support librarians and library systems and to facilitate cooperation across those lines of school, public, academic, and special libraries. So we have an interesting role here to provide continuing education, to kind of plug the holes where there are areas that need addressing, and then also to react to the special needs of our members. So I'm here today to convey our thanks and appreciation for the increase that the multi-types received and to give you some insight into how that money is being spent. With that flat funding for 10 years, we have had to address some of the less than glamorous issues of infrastructure. Mark mentioned, you know, replacing your computers, maintaining your delivery vehicles, all those sorts of things are important to make things happen. So we have invested in some of that. But with that increased infrastructure comes the ability to provide resource and delivery sharing. In some of our areas, Southeast Library System Cells, which is headquartered in Rochester, has been able to add an additional day of delivery to their school libraries, which is very important. CMLE in Central Minnesota, SMILE in the South Central area, and North Country Library Cooperative have all been able to maintain their delivery. They have not had to cut back on delivery to their members because of the increase. And in Northern Lights, up in the Northwest area, some delivery initiatives have been started to cooperate with the library systems in that area to continue delivery to the schools and special libraries in that region. Group purchasing of databases make some of those essential online resources available in various areas, as well as MetroNet has collaborated with Minitex and with the State Library Services to purchase a statewide subscription to WebJunction, which is a national library resource that provides online continuing education, online discussion forums, We have a statewide continuing education calendar on Web Junction. So that's an important resource we've been able to add as a result of our increase. And in the southwest corner of the state, SAMI, the multi-type in that area, is working on regional cooperation to improve library programming to teens. There will be additional programming at local public libraries and also at media centers. Continuing education is a big part of every multi-type goal and mission. And with this increase, we've been able to develop in a cooperative way statewide a program called 23 Things on a Stick. This is a self-paced online learning program aimed at library staff at all levels, as well as board members, friends of the library, and just about anybody with a library connection. It's one of those programs where we were hoping, you know, 1,000 or so people would participate, and on the other hand, we were afraid 1,000 people would participate because of the details. But as of today, we have over 1,000 people signed up to learn about Web 2.0 tools and their applications in libraries and media centers. It's a very exciting program, and it runs through mid-April, and I believe the response is that we will probably run a round 2 of that program, or even a round 3 and 4, or expand it to include additional tools. So that's very exciting for us. It's very timely to have this increase because we have been able to restore and expand continuing education scholarships for our members. And it's timely because the National Conference of the Public Library Association will be in Minneapolis later this month. It's great to have a national conference and unusual for Minnesota library staff to be able to attend a national conference, so we have expanded our scholarships for that. In Metronet, here in the Twin Cities, we've also been able to expand our Metronet Information Literacy Initiative to 3 school districts. We have over 50 media specialists and teachers learning how to implement the information technology literacy standards that are now embedded in the content standards. We're teaching methods and tools for how to get those information literacy concepts across in the classroom. And that is a project that could be replicated statewide, so we're very conscious of how we develop that so that while we have many resources here in the Twin Cities that makes it easy for us, it would also be possible to replicate that throughout the state. Fostering interlibrary cooperation, of course, is the foundation of multi-type library systems. We are able, through this, to expand our cooperation in the Northern Lights area by increasing the membership in the North Star Library Consortium, which is a library management system that has as its members school, special, and academic libraries. And they are also considering additional membership in that. This makes it possible for individual buildings, districts, schools, libraries that would not be able to have a library management system on their own to benefit from that cooperation. Northern Lights has also expanded their early literacy. We've heard from Melanie how important early literacy is. And Northern Lights is working in collaboration with 3 Indian reservations in their region to promote early literacy programming there. Also, Metronet is working with its public, private, academic libraries, also with local school districts as well as public libraries, to plan a conference to address the big issue of alignment. Alignment is a buzzword in academic libraries and colleges these days. Are our students learning in high school what they need to succeed in college or other post-high school education? And with our information literacy project, we're bringing together a panel of nationally known speakers to address those issues as they relate to teaching information literacy and the research process. So these are just a few of the highlights of the activities that we have been able to implement as a result of our increase. And once again, I really do thank you for that and appreciate your continued support of libraries of all types throughout Minnesota.
Thank you so much, Ms. Smalley, Walter Smalley. I don't quite get how this map fits with this map.
That's the map we're talking about. There are 7 regions that are multi-type systems, and they do not exactly, the founders do not exactly coincide with the regional public library systems. And I have to say, being relatively new to Minnesota, I'm not sure how those boundaries were defined.
Okay. Well, we'll wait till after then.
Yes, that was my...
But this is one that, the one that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. I'll save that for the wind up. Mr. DeJohn, welcome back.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill DeJohn. I am the director of the Minitex Library Information Network, a program of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education and the University of Minnesota. I want to thank each of you for your support for Minitex during the last legislative session. We've been able to continue our collaboration and cooperation, serving academic students, faculty, and state government employees, and collaborating with K-12 students and teachers in the general public library community. You have a handout on salmon that I'll be referring to. On the first page, you'll see that these are the players that we have and that fund us. You fund us with $5.6 million annually to the Office of Higher Education. We are located at the University of Minnesota. We are part of the University Library. On page 2, our mission is to enhance the... Essentially, we're trying to make libraries look good in the eyes of their users by providing services to those libraries for their patrons. We also promote partnerships, return on investment, resource sharing, and training, and we are constantly trying to pursue technological innovation in order to help libraries become more efficient and effective. Our Electronic Library for Minnesota provides equitable access to information resources here in Minnesota. Our Minlink Gateway, which you funded, facilitates equitable and shared access to library and information resources. We have over 33 million volumes available. All the academic libraries and the regional public libraries that you heard about earlier are on that system, and so they share resources with each other, and Minnesotans have access to those resources. The Minnesota Digital Library Coalition, which is funded by a federal grant from the Minnesota Department of Education, but administered by Minitex, we are digitizing the state's unique historical resources and making those available. And the Research Project Calculator, which we'll show in a few minutes, which is something that we've developed for K-12, middle and high schools. On page 3, it's all about partnerships and collaboration. On the left of that page, you'll see that we are funded to serve the regional public library systems that you heard about, K-12 schools, and the multi-type library systems by the Department of Education. On the right side of that page, we are funded through the Office of Higher Education to serve MinSCU, the state government libraries, University of Minnesota libraries, and the Minnesota private colleges. On the fourth page is just another description of the services that I've mentioned and how they relate. What we're really trying to do here is improve student and faculty research by providing supplemental information for those campuses, as well as information to state government employees. On the left, you'll see a list of the programs that we work closely with. And again, in the diagram there, you can see the relationships with each other. On page 5, the dollars that you've given us have helped us to continue to maintain our service program to serve Minnesotans. We've had a 79% increase in our delivery volume since fiscal 06. That's quite an increase. The fuel surcharges are kind of hard to plan for. We are trying to speed up delivery as we work 5 days a week and trying to move materials overnight to libraries throughout the state. We had a 17% increase in requests for book loans and photocopies over the last several months. We are in some cases receiving 1,000 to 2,000 requests a day for book loans and photocopies, and we really try to keep those going because we don't want to fall behind. Slipping 2 days causes us problems. Over 50,000 book loans and photocopies have been delivered from the university library's collection to Minnesotans through their libraries in the last 7 months. Scholarly resources we've been able to maintain through your appropriation for libraries to serve students and faculty in Minnesota. to supplement their local resources. Those subject areas are nursing, chemistry, health, science, and the humanities. We spend over $900,000 to supplement and subsidize those campuses for those resources. We continue to provide the Elm resources, and we've been able to meet increased vendor fees over the last 6 to 7 months. And last fiscal year, we ended up with over 11 million searches in the Elm databases. We are hoping to add electronic resources to Elm. We are in the process of working through that right now, hopefully in the area of health or sciences. We've upgraded our equipment, our computers, as well as our scanners in order to increase the quality of the delivery of information, because we are now sending well over 70,000 articles directly to patrons or libraries electronically over the Internet. We're maintaining our staff levels, which your appropriation helps us to do, in order to continue these services. We've had over a 20% increase in the Middling Gateway activities in the last 7 months. Those are materials that are going back and forth between the libraries. You have a brochure on the MinLink Gateway with you there, and that's a very, very interesting program that over the last fiscal year we had over 400,000 requests moving through that system, and Minnesotans are using that on a daily basis, including the weekends, since we can tell every Monday morning that they've been active over the weekend. And then the Minnesota Digital Library, with over 20,000 Minnesota images, historical images, and documents that are available for Minnesotans. And we actually have a very active program reaching out to K-12 and higher education to help students use those historical images and documents in their coursework. And the last page, essentially, there was some comments made by users about the Minitech services that I pulled off this morning. Those were in the last several weeks, in terms of people who actually are using the service and appreciate the legislative support that continues to provide them supplemental information for their research needs. I thank members of the committee.
Thank you.
Sure. Let me introduce Leslie Yoder, who will talk about the Research Project Calculator. This was a program written and developed as open source software by the University of Minnesota Libraries to serve the undergraduates in the University of Minnesota. We took the open source software language, and with my IT staff and with Leslie's help and another media specialist, they took that and adapted it for K-12, primarily, I think, middle school and high school. And then last year we actually added to that, and she'll talk about that program in just a minute.
Okay. And Ms. Yoder, you're with the St. Paul School?
I'm with St. Paul Public Schools. I'm a licensed library media specialist and secondary teacher, and I work in the Department of Education and Technology in St. Paul Schools.
Okay. All right.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here with you. As you've just heard, I was fortunate enough to be able to spend a couple summers with Jane Prestipak from Robbinsdale Public Schools developing this research project calculator. And you see it displayed on the screen. It's a little tricky because it's small, but you also have in front of you a bookmark that shows the steps that this calculator follows and provides the web address and some other information. What we found is that within the current era of information, the research process has become very, very, it's more complex than ever. And students need help navigating it. Teachers also need help navigating it, because we can find that the adults aren't always ready to be in front of the students in terms of leading them. So the first year of this project, what it essentially did was use the five-step research process that's outlined in the memo information and technology standards that are being used for the content standards. It used that five-step process and created a structure to help students go through the research process and create a project or an end product. And it also allowed for options other than a traditional written product. as an end result. So I will go in the way you, the student goes in and enters their information, and then they can choose the format, essay, slide presentation, or video. And we'll go with the slide presentation here. I'm not going to enter in my contact info, and we're going to get this done in 10 days. So I'll calculate the project schedule. This is what a student would see. I'll go through and tell them how many days they have to finish. It outlines the five steps, which are question, gather, conclude, communicate, and evaluate. And so this unit is a question-based format. The students then would go in to the individual questions, and it essentially walks them through, much like a coach or a teacher guide by their side in terms of what needs to happen and what they need to think about as they navigate this process. What we found after year one was that this was very well received, was very, very widely used, but there was a need for more support at the teaching end in terms of helping our teachers be the leaders in the research process. So we, this last summer, with funding from Minitech, were able to go back and create the teacher side, the teacher guide. So this, what I've just gone into, in many ways, I think this has really, really added a lot of value to this this tool. It explains to the teacher what the research process is, what their role is in the process. It talks about working with library media specialists, outlines what they need to do and think about before they begin, and then it has some very, very nice features. For example, for the busy teacher who looks at this and their eyes glaze over because they're already way in over their head, and I think that might include more than a few of our teachers given all the things on their plate these days. This is the no time, the quick and easy version of the calculator. We also have guiding questions to assist the teacher and the librarian in their role as the coach for the research process. And one of the probably the nicest parts of this resource are the support materials. If the format and the structure don't appeal to everyone in terms of the way it's set up, there are support materials to meet every need, and they are all posted in PDF form and Word form so they can be edited and used however educator might want to use them. So they are, and they're organized according to the five steps. And I'm going to back up, and I'm going to go into this communication piece and show you as well in terms of the students actually producing an electronic slide presentation. They're really, really nice resources embedded within this. This is the slide the side-by-side view, where it's almost like a traditional textbook with the student side, the student version on one side and the teacher version on the other side, so the teacher can work off of what the student would see. So that's our research project calculator. Questions?
How does the student use this then?
What we do within, I've been working with Ann Walker Smalley in the Information Literacy Project and in St. Paul's with our St. Paul School teachers. And this is our second year working with that project. And what we found is that sometimes we've encouraged teachers to think about approaching the research process with their students, from a dribbling aspect, that sometimes taking a student to this and dropping them off, as it were, and saying, well, good luck, here's the guide for you, it can be not really true. So what we attempt to do is help our teachers see ways to teach pieces of the process along the way, using the tools embedded in here, using tools, using the collaborative opportunities with their school librarians. And students very, very often will go and use this as a resource as they're working on a project. If they, for example, are doing a video, a documentary video, and they need, they don't remember one part of it or one way that they're supposed to do something, they can go in and use this tool as a resource to guide them or remind them of what the steps, how the steps are supposed to be followed. It also, just in terms of perhaps giving a larger scope here, it starts, it has at the beginning and end a very, very nice rubric which helps outline the entire process. And let me, I'm in the actual step itself. I think what I'm going to do is go back to the documents, the supporting documents, and pull up the rubric. Under support materials, all the way down. And this is it works as an overview to help both the teacher and the student understand both the specific steps and the larger goals. Can I answer your question in terms of how the students use it? It's going to be used in a number of ways, and it will really depend on the level of students, the expertise of the students, their comfort level with the research process, and also how the teacher is approaching the process and what they're expecting of students, whether it be a large-scale project or they're teaching, focusing on skills, on teaching the skills with less emphasis on product. Mm-hmm.
Representative Erickson, thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers, or specifically to Ms. Yoder, can we access this without coming to the library? And would you tell us how we can do that? Because I'm very curious.
It's accessible from anywhere in the world with internet access, and it is in fact being used all over the world. Our stats show that it's being very widely used, in addition to Prime Minister's students and many of these school districts. The address is on this bookmark that you all received. It's at the top, rtc.elm4u.org. We tried to keep it really simple for folks so that kids could memorize this and be able to do it off the top of their head. So it's right in there. Other questions or things I can clarify regarding the calculator?
I don't quite get it. It sounds like, as Representative Peterson says, a lot of work has been put into this, and I can see that from up there, but I can't quite see me use it in the classroom.
What it acts as a teaching resource as well as a guide for students as they are going through the pieces of a project or discussing a project, much like a textbook or much like a handout would. I believe that's how it functions.
And because the teacher's not around a lot, they can get the information or they can have this outline to follow to gather their information.
I think it provides the structure. It provides the structure for both the teacher and the student in the form of the steps, the five steps, the resources, the explanation of the steps, and the explanation of what needs to happen before one begins each one of the steps.
Okay. Representative Plowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question. could do apply this to the legislative process and then we set a timeline perhaps at the committee level or maybe the House and Senate and really? And we'd know where we are. So you, Madam Chair, I think that's an affirmative. This might expedite some of our problems that we've had this session, particularly for chairs who've had 300 or 400 bills in their committee and they're trying to expedite this. I can see this. I may have to log on and just see if we can apply it.
And you have a packet of these.
I have one right here, Madam Chair. I'm ready.
There's a packet in front of you that you can pass them out to people that you feel would...
Well, Madam Chair, I'm glad I came down because I have this or I have Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. I wasn't sure which one. And now I think I could use both.
Very good. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. After that, I'm not sure I want to speak. But as I understand that this is for research projects, right? And it's not only available to students. It looks like on the back here that it's available for folks, just Minnesota residents who might want to. So that might that might answer Representative Pawlowski's question. And then I was fascinated to stay on track with email reminders. Is that built into the system too?
Yesterday it was a little more simplified, but now we have built-in email reminders for students for each step of the process, and we can do email reminders for the teachers as well. Keep them on track with their end of the teaching the process.
And I know how difficult research projects are for beginners, and also for all students who are doing
it. And for the parents.
And parents, right. That is very true. And having this kind of tool available, I think it's just really exciting.
It's been a really wonderful project to work with, and reception has been extremely positive in the youth in the state.
So, Mr. DeChong, what did Minitech get out of this? You gave a grant to Ms. Yoder, and she developed this with her colleagues, and they're using it now, and so does it save Minitech people's time and energy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what we've done here is we've linked ELM and Minlink Gateway into the research project calculator. So when students are doing research, they can actually go in to find resources in ELM or in the Minlink Gateway. I've also found in talking to two-year college librarians that they feel that this particular tool can be of use for undergraduates entering the two-year college system. And there are several colleges, two-year colleges, that have this up on their webpage. So I think we've gotten a lot of mileage from this particular project. And we're very happy to be able to use it for K-12 as well as for the two-year colleges, and I think it's a good example of the collaboration between higher education and K-12.
Any other questions at this time? Thank you. Don't run away. Peg Werner, Viking Library System.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peg Werner, and I am the director of the Viking Library System. It's headquartered in Fergus Falls. And it has been many years since I've come to talk to many of you about telecommunications, but I'm back again. I would say of all the things you're hearing about this afternoon, definitely what I have to say is the least glamorous topic on your agenda because it is infrastructure. But I can also tell you that all of the things you heard about this afternoon, the things that you hear about presented to your committee, and the things you see demonstrated when you go back to your district, Minlink and ELM, the research calculator, the computerized library catalogs, the public access to the Internet, foreign language, ITV classes, we're doing Mandarin Chinese in Underwood, field trips to other countries, partnering with classrooms around the world, the Otter Tail kids are comparing their water clarity with that of Russia, watching surgery at the university in rural area classrooms, everything that is wonderful and exciting and necessary and adventurous in K-12 schools and in public libraries runs on one single network, and that's the network I'm going to tell you about. Minnesota is very fortunate that the legislature in 1995 had the foresight and vision to establish a single
high-speed telecommunications network in Minnesota. I think sometimes when we look at communities or particularly roads, we look at things and say, gee, if we knew then what we know now, we wish we could go back and lay them all out over again. This is a network that got to be laid out correctly from the very, very beginning. So it is a cooperation between higher education in Minnesota, K-12 schools, and public libraries. The backbone is shared by everyone, as is the switching equipment. The smaller lines go out to the communities. So if you can think of big pipes of information going up and down the highways, which they follow quite carefully, big pipes going out long distances, as they start to veer off, they get smaller. When they get to smaller towns, they're smaller, and as they switch to public libraries and schools, they turn into lines, and then it all comes back again. And when the sharing and switching is done, we do it regionally so that we're sharing that equipment. It is a wonderfully cost-efficient structure, and it's something that we've kept in place for a long time. When we were building it, you remember, we were here a lot with bills and testimony and discussions, and people wondered how on earth we would use all this bandwidth and what would be done on it. And those discussions sort of dropped away as more and more became about applications and things that people are doing. We also used to have an enormous philosophical and organizational structure around it. We had task forces and councils and all kinds of things that sort of managed this network. That has really dissolved, too, into about six people. There are truly about six people around the state. I represent public libraries in that very small group. And we watch the network, and we make sure that there's enough bandwidth and it's going in the right place. And as technology changes, we bring in different things. But other than that, there isn't much to discuss. The network is funded in a cooperative manner, as Elaine was saying. The Higher Ed Committee in the legislature funds the Learning Network of Minnesota, which is what they still call it on the higher ed side. The K-12 Committee funds Telecom Equity Aid, which is the program that funds K-12 schools. And the K-12 Committee also funds Regional Library Telecommunications Aid, called RLTA, for the library. These all sound very separate. They're all funded separately. They're all programs that are applied for separately. But when the money comes together, it's still for a single network. We do not have redundant networks. We don't have redundant equipment. We all come together and share them. The partnership is actually a federal partnership with state and local government involvement. When we talk to the legislature, we often only mention the state part. We don't really talk about the other two pieces, and they are interesting pieces as well. The federal government joins the state government with their E-rate reduction program. And so the state and federal government together are doing that big backbone. And when we started this, we decided that the clearest line would be the wall of the building. So everything that's outside of a building is funded by the state and federal government. Everything that's inside of the building is the local part. And the local part, we have found, we've done studies probably every 3 or 4 years, and they're always the same, so it doesn't seem to be changing much. But the local part is about 2 to 2.5 times higher than the state and federal combined. And that's because they're doing not only internal wiring, they're doing computer hardware and technical support, the application software. There's a lot that goes on in the building that doesn't go on outside of the building. The E-rate reduction program, I'm sure you all know about it, but the schools and libraries are required to apply. And just for your own information, the federal government across Minnesota pays for about 55%. About 55% of the network that I've been talking about is E-rate reduction. 45% is all of the rest of those funding sources from the state I was talking about. It is certainly not even across the state. In Viking, it's 62% federal, 38% state. It's because we have higher free and reduced lunch in our area than other places. That's what it's based on. But if you took the state as a whole and you sort of averaged out all the years, it runs about 55 to 45%, just to give you some sort of context. The Regional Public Library Systems also received an increase in RLTA last year. It was a very good year for libraries. We received an increase of just over $1 million, and that has helped us with our bandwidth needs. It isn't necessarily that we have lots and lots of more workstations or more buildings or anything like that. It's that the bandwidth that's being used increases because of the uses that are being done on the network. For those of you who have been around for 10 years, you remember when it was text only. And then it went to graphic, and then it went to motion, and then it went to music, and now we're doing surgery. And when you do that, it just eats up bandwidth. That's all that's doing. When the NCAA tournaments went on live streaming video, public libraries knew we were in trouble because all of our computer labs were filled with people downloading that. Some of our libraries got really smart and projected that in a single room and said, everybody that wants to watch basketball go in here so that they didn't have to have it on 12 workstations. They could put it on one. Another thing that we've done that's been really interesting, that I think, is that we've partitioned part of our bandwidth off that we have just in a library building.
with a router and set up wireless all over the building. And I know that you're all aware of this because people say, I'll duck into a public library and use their wireless for a minute. But it's been very helpful to us because we haven't needed the workstations. So many people carry laptops or whatever they have with them, and they just need a wireless access that we've really been able to at least approach some of our space issues by just offering wireless. In our very small buildings, we have the same size of routers as we do in every other building, and people use the parking lots and the nearby cafes, and it's wonderful. In small town Minnesota, they still advertise free wireless courtesy of your public library, which is Minnesota. It is a tremendous asset that the state of Minnesota has given to schools and libraries. We used to talk about this a lot and tell you all, but I think that you know that now. When I heard a man say, I'm going to log on, when I heard Representative Erickson say, where's the website, we didn't used to have conversations like that at all. So it's wonderful to hear it. It's wonderful to be part of the infrastructure that's just in the background now that we don't have to talk about anymore. But just the same, we thank you all very much. We know that we depend on it every single day. And if you have questions, I think there are people all over the room that might come up and answer them.
Ms. Werner, thank you for your enthusiasm. Contagious. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know, Ms. Werner, if you can answer this or not. I know that there's like five libraries in the state that are not part of the regional library system.
Yes.
What can we do to try to get those libraries to become part? And there's different reasons, as I understand.
Different reasons. And they've always had the opportunity to become part of the regional system. They still do. Their regional systems meet and talk with them probably once a year. A couple of these are very, very small libraries. They're open 8 and 9 hours a week. Sometimes what we do on a statewide basis isn't appropriate for every single community. Some of the things that Melanie was talking about, some of the huge libraries with 100 computer labs, are not necessarily appropriate when you're open 9 hours a week. It's not what you want to do or be. And that's fine. The regional systems that contain those libraries, talk to them, but we're very live and let live in the library world. And if that's what you want to do, you're certainly welcome to do so. If there are other things, I understand the one that Crosby is part of. Crosby is one of the unaffiliated, they're part of Kitchigami. I understand that they're looking at their agreement now. That, I believe, had to do with the fact that it's an endowed library,
yeah.
And the people that gave the endowment did not want to ever have the city of Crosby have to tax their citizens for library service, and if they joined the region, they would. And so it's sort of an issue of endowment and taxes and that kind of thing. They're looking at sort of an affiliate relationship so that they could take part in some of the services but not necessarily have to involve the city, thereby not infringing on the endowment, that kind of thing. So everyone is different. Certainly the regional systems are always open to talking to them and welcoming them in. And if they don't want to, again, like I said, it can be a live and let live world too, and people can do the kinds of things they want.
Representative Ford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up. And I appreciate the information that you gave us on the Crosby Library, because that's I've visited with somebody recently just about that, and I'm glad to hear that maybe we're moving some forward movement on that situation. But going back to the fact that, you know, although each one of them are individualized and have different needs and means and things as such, there is a part that they don't get because they're not part of the regional, or some services that they're not able to receive because they're not part of the regional library system. So it would be nice if somehow we could connect, you know, all services available to all Minnesotans for all, you know, for all libraries, based on, just as you said, even if they're open for 8 or 9 hours a week or whatever, some, those citizens aren't able to receive some of those services because they choose not to be part of that.
I understand that, and the cooperation for state funding, which I believe are the services that you're talking about, has always been based on the fact that you collaborate as well. And so those libraries would need to accept everybody's library card, which they don't now. They need to participate in interlibrary loan. And I run a system that has worked with schools for a long time on interlibrary loan. And I can honestly say that there are institutions in the state that are not set up for that. My office has a space that is just interlibrary loan. We have elementary schools that have a paraprofessional and a director who works out of a car. I can't imagine. It was 9 buildings. I can't imagine that she would do interlibrary loan. So I think those conversations, even though we can have them on a state level and say all of this should be this, when you get down to the individual conversation, you hear such stories of why things work and don't work. And certainly, if those libraries want to join in and want to share their things, and welcome other people into the resources. The regional library systems are certainly willing to extend all of the state paid for services that they have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative
Flowers. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ward, to your point, I feel compelled to bring this up at this point. As there is a bill traveling through on this. I don't know if you knew that. It was my bill. I just want to make it clear it's not my bill anymore. Jeremy Kalin is carrying that because it affects one of his libraries in Taylor's Falls. But I know that they had a hearing, a two-hour hearing on that in the Senate. And so people are talking about that, and it's a very serious issue. So I just wanted, that's my editorial comment. So thank you.
Okay. Any other questions of Ms. Warner or Ms. Yoder? Representative Peters, and
thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Warner, do we still have a disparity on the e-rate? I know you mentioned areas or regions, but isn't it also true that it could be from district to district where we have this difference in the e-rate?
Mm-hmm. E-rates are based on free and reduced school lunches. And so any school or public library that's within that school district are based on what they are. The higher your free and reduced school lunch, the more e-rate you get. And it happens that we pay for this network with the federal money first. So everything we get in E-rate, we apply first. And then the amount that is our RLTA is prorated by the state library beyond that. Sometimes we have enough money to actually meet all of the needs. Sometimes it's a little bit short, and then regional library systems kick in. That was one of the reasons we came forward and asked for more money. Last year, we hadn't done that since 2000 because we were real sort of on the line with our bandwidth. We also brought in two other libraries that had not been in the network, and that changed things a bit. But you're absolutely right. It fluctuates all over the place, and it's a federal government program, and we're grateful for the funding, and we just comply as we can.
Does the money come through the Department of Education, or does it come directly from the feds?
It comes directly from the feds. It's always meant to be a reduction, so you're supposed to get a smaller telephone bill. That has never happened since 1996. We're trying to catch up with calendar. But no, you go ahead and then you just get checks back, and they come back to the people who have spent the money. And then we don't actually turn in our final amount to the state until the end of the year. So it's always based on invoices rather than projections.
Now, does every one of these systems operate the same way?
They operate the same way in telecom. They operate very, very differently, but in telecom we try to keep it very close.
Okay. And so when classrooms, you talked about a couple classrooms doing, comparing water, their water with the Russians' water, and when they want to go with Paul Shirky to the Arctic, or North Pole, mm-hmm. or wherever they're going, then that's through this telecommunication.
Through the learning network in Minnesota. Yes, and it goes to every single public school and every public library that is part of a regional system. You're right, sir. Every library that's part of a regional system is on that network, as are the higher ed.
What about the classrooms that are pals with another classroom, like in Georgia or something, like the Duluth Graham mm-hmm. School, communicating regularly on a daily basis with Duluth, Georgia. That's
over
the same thing?
Same network.
Okay.
For a long time, people thought also that people access the internet over a different network in a public library. It's all the same network. A wonderful plan, a wonderful vision to do it that way. Mm-hmm. This way we can just add bandwidth. We can watch our regional switches, up the regional switches, and there's no redundancy at all. So. Very well done.
Great. All right. Ms. Pitt, do you have anything else in summation?
Madam Chair, no. Those are our witnesses, and we'd certainly be open to questions if the committee has any.
I guess what's this elm, Mr. Dijon?
Hello.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is the Electronic Library for Minnesota. The legislature funded this several years ago, first in the higher education bills, and then in the K-12 committees. So it's funded $900,000 from the K-12 committee, and I think we are now spending over $1 million in Minnesex appropriation from higher ed. All of these resources have been put together in order to provide Minnesotans with access to full-text articles, reference books, electronic books, etc. For example, we also have in here the professional collection for teachers and for faculty members. And so these are accessible from home or from the library or from the school.
And we have the same www address as we do for Ms. Yoder's program?
Yes, the difference is in Ms. Yoder's program it's RPC. In Elm it's www.elmforyou.org.
Oh. See there, I wouldn't have noticed that, and I would have wondered how come I can't get in there, and she said it was still going to be so easy and then my project would be overdue. Oh, what does RPC mean?
Research Project Calculator.
Ah. Oh.
We try to make it simple, but I'm afraid we sometimes make it more complicated.
Well, not necessarily. It's just that some of us have to become more familiar. Okay. Don't run off. Just everyone that talks, you come back and move chairs so that they could sit there in case we have questions. I have a couple.
Actually, Madam Chair, Ms. Yoder did have some additional testimony that she had planned to present on a school library media center. Would it be possible for her to take a few minutes to do that?
Sure.
All right.
But let me get these other questions out of the way first.
Okay.
what Mr. Ranum, you said you want computers replaced every 3 years instead of every 6 years. Why? Holy cow. 3 years?
Madam Chair, that figure is one example of a regional public library system that was on a 6-year schedule for replacing their public access computers. After 6 years, a lot of the computers, actually after 3 years, a lot of the computers that people were using were not keeping up with the requirements, basic memory requirements, speed requirements, hardware requirements, and sometimes software requirements in order to run the types of programs that were required by either citizens or the public or school kids who came in after school. They couldn't run the kind of programs that were required for them to do the work they needed to do. So in this case, what we're looking at is just an opportunity for them to use some additional state dollars to keep those resources up to date and to keep their hardware and software up to date so that the people could actually accomplish the goals that they had set out.
But if we go on that kind of a revolving replacement thing, then am I going to be able to get my John Grisham book as fast as I could before?
That's because the intent is that you would get it even more quickly and you would get it even more efficiently because you wouldn't spend a whole lot of time waiting for the catalog to refresh on the old computer. On the new computer, the catalog would come right up and allow you to run software.
No, I just go to the shelf with new books and pick the book up. But
that's right.
Now they might not be able to buy that new book because they're so busy doing this, using the money on technology.
Madam Chair, the balance between technology and other resources in public libraries is a constant issue for all of us and for our local boards of directors and for our regional boards of directors. I believe that you'll see that most local communities are putting the emphasis on local resources. The idea being that they want you to have the books in your library when you want them. On the shelf so you can just walk in and browse. But still, the majority of youth in public libraries are people walking in the door and checking out books and returning books, having them checked in and put back on the shelf for other users. But remember that resources are only the foundation for most of the outcomes that we're trying to achieve in public libraries. So it's not as, we've determined that it's not as good just to have the children's books in the library. The intent is that we want kids to learn to read, and we want them to be effective learners by the time they enter school. So we develop story times, but it's not enough to have story times. Now we need to know exactly what it is in terms of the behaviors in story time and the activities in story time that help brain development. So we went out and researched that, and now Ms. Huggins was talking about, we do have that research behind us, and we've developed story times that are very targeted, that use the research, that develop children's brains in the way that they're ready to become learners, and the resources support all of those activities. I assure you, we're working on having as many books as possible in the libraries for you.
All right. Ms. Huggins, he brought your name up again. And you talked about all the things that you were doing with these little kids and this early childhood stuff and the book and free books, and that was you, right?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And then you said sometimes parents don't realize that they're child's first teachers.
Absolutely.
How do you, my gosh. If they don't realize that, are they coming to the library?
Madam Chair, that's a great question, because they don't always come to us. We have to go to them as well. There are a couple issues at play here. Having worked in a library and been a children's librarian in an affluent neighborhood, I know that there are a lot of affluent parents or stay-at-home moms that take care of their children that don't realize that there are six things that have to develop in that child's brain, and they're very, you know, research-based, and they don't know how in simple ways that they can do these things. We don't focus on the six skills and, you know, calling them phonological awareness and things like that. We focus on reminding the parents that it's their job to talk, read, and write with their kids as much as possible from birth to five. And so if you're looking from an affluent parents' perspective, they might think if they pay for enough Kinder music, then their child's going to be ready to go to school. And unfortunately, that's not all there is to it. It's the way that you talk to your child. It's how you engage them. It's reading to them 20 minutes every day. It's not skipping over the hard words in books because you don't think they're going to know the word. They have to build the vocabulary. So it's very simple things that every parent can do. Now, when we're talking about urban libraries and we're talking about very diverse demographics, there are a lot of cultures that we serve here in St. Paul and that a lot of our Minnesota libraries serve that think that learning doesn't start until they set foot in kindergarten. And they really do see it as a teacher's job to teach their child. So we're working with, you know, across the spectrum, very different knowledge base, very different skill sets. But it's amazing that across that spectrum, how many people will say, I didn't know that just by using these nursery rhymes in this way, I was developing these skills. And so we find that our kind of work is never done in that area, because you're always seeing new parents and new young children coming to the library.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yep. And then you have to go and work with the child care workers, and you have to go to the early childhood classes, and you have to go to the Head Start places.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. And the thing that you're talking about,
they already know. Those people already know.
Well, no, but not necessarily. When you look at who we have working in our libraries, we have very well-educated staff and people with master's degrees. That's not always who you have working in your child care facility. You don't have people with that kind of background and training, and there's a lot of turnover in child care. So even if one good teacher knows, you know how competitive it is to get good teachers in child care, they're getting plucked off from one place to another. They're changing jobs. So it's a constant revolving door of us going to meet them where they are, which takes tremendous staff resources. When we're seeing more and more people coming to the doors, more and more people using technology, we had a 122% increase in our program attendance last year. So we know people are coming to these programs. That means somebody's got to be there to mind the store, but we also need enough librarians and enough educated people with the right skills and the right techniques and the right resources going out into the community and building those alliances and collaborations with other people who serve youth.
Okay. Ms. Smalley, Ms. Walker Smalley, what about this national conference that's coming?
The Public Library Association, which is a division of the American Library Association, is having its national meeting here at the end of March.
What do they do there?
Well, they talk about any library-related topic you can think of. It's a tremendous continuing education opportunity for librarians, really, from any type of library, because there are national speakers, the opportunity to network with those experts and to learn what the latest and greatest trends are in libraries. In 2 years, we were lucky again, and the American Association of School Librarians, which is another subset of ALA, will have their national conference here. So we expect that many school librarians from across the state will be able to attend that. So the national conference is a valuable thing, you know, economically, of course, they'll have an impact on Minneapolis and the surrounding area, but also from our standpoint, educationally, we think that librarians from all types of libraries, as well as our board members. I know Metronet, for example, has several board members who will be attending the Public Library Association conference, and that's always an eye-opening experience to see what libraries are faced with and the decisions that they have to make when it comes to purchasing those databases and the early childhood materials.
This committee might like a little more information on how to
attend,
visit that place.
We'd be happy to provide that information.
The speakers are in. Do authors come?
Yes, there are authors that come. I believe Nancy...
Are there little booths, like a...
Oh.
Fair? Like a
the
fair?
The exhibits are worth the price of admission.
You get a canvas bag.
Canvas bag. Plastic bags with every possible vendor's name on them. Yes, the exhibits alone are eye-opening, and I do think that's where a lot of learning takes place, particularly for people who are not in a library every day, like board members, where they see how many decisions a librarian has to make over how to spend that budget that they have. So it is possible. We'd be happy to provide the committee with information on attendance. You can attend just with an exhibit pass, which allows you to attend the opening and closing sessions as well as the exhibits, or you could attend the entire conference or one day of the conference.
We might be a little busy, but
yes,
you know it's when we have a
last week of
hour or two of spare time.
Yes, it is the last week of March. I believe it starts on March 23rd, but we'd be happy to send you that information and would encourage you to attend or contact your local librarian to see if they're going to attend, and it sometimes helps to have a knowledgeable escort at something like this, just because it will be a lot of librarians all in one place at one time.
I think the Ramsey County librarian and the Washington County librarian have mentioned this before, and I think I might want to catch up with them.
So I believe Nancy Pearl is going to attend, and you may have heard her. She is a very she's often on the radio talking about books and reading. You might enjoy her speech as well.
Oh, is that the one from Oregon?
Washington. She's also visiting, you know, as a side note, she is doing workshops throughout the state of Minnesota this spring and again in the fall, talking about reader's advisory and collection development, which you also may be interested in learning about.
Ah.
More collaboration and cooperation across various types of libraries to bring Nancy Pearl here.
Great. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, and Ms. Walker Smalley. I'm assuming that, that conference is happening, the national conference is happening right now, is here in the cities, in the city area, St. Paul. Or
it's at the Minneapolis Convention Center, the last week in March, right at the end of March.
Well, in 2 years when you have your school library and conference, I'd like to invite you to Brainerd, Minnesota, which is central Minnesota, and everybody could
thank you, Madam Chair. We'll pass that recommendation on to the American Library Association. Maybe in the summer.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if among all of our testifiers, we could find out the ratio of hits through, you know, Mintex or Minnet or Metronet, I should say, and books actually checked out. I mean, how does that compare today? Are we still getting as many consumers walking out with a hard copy, you know, like a Grissom book or Madam Chair, or are we having more activity on the internet?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, The Internet has not in any way replaced the normal activity of people using the library to check books out for whatever reason. Collections are growing. The number of people circulating books and checking them out and returning them are growing. And increasing the circulation of public libraries in particular are the number of formats materials come in. So as we had books on tape and then moved into books on CD for commuters or people who travel, that increased circulation. Libraries are always looking at ways in which to provide those materials the public can use in formats that are useful to them. Not only are we looking at those kind of increases, but we're also looking at increases in library services across this wide spectrum of electronic services. So when we talked about books on CD being sort of the latest thing, the real latest thing, of course, is downloadable audiobooks where people can sit at home, check out a book, download it to their computer, download it off to their mobile player, listen to it on their iPod at their leisure, and then the book just disappears after a certain period of time. So there isn't even a reason to return it at that point. So in terms of statistics about people using library services, we're seeing greater increases partly because the need for basic information and people's desire to read the print materials has not gone away, but also because libraries are doing a terrific job in terms of marketing their services, in terms of being in the community, and word of mouth is always our best advertising. People who use library services talk positively about their library use and about what they're getting from libraries, and we find that that's the best way to find new users is they come in with friends, with family. Sometimes the most entertainment we get are when kids bring their parents into the library to talk about what they saw on the school visit to the library, and then they bring their parents in, and the parents have not used libraries for years and become regular users. So we're finding that all of those services together make a very attractive package for individuals, families, groups to come in and use library services.
Thank you. Ms. Yoder.
I do have this on a PowerPoint because I have a couple graphics that I wanted you to see. Thank you again for the opportunity to talk to you about school libraries. What I'm going to do is talk about some of the issues related to school libraries and the importance. And we're in the 21st century, but in regard to school libraries and skills that our students have, we can't necessarily say that our students are developing the 21st century skills that they need to develop. And I, the weekend, was at a conference with small business owners, and Stephen Covey, keynoted at that conference, and they talked over and over and over again about knowledge workers. And it was really curious to me, in terms of the role of the school library in Minnesota, because, again, I'm going to address a couple of different issues here. We have some misconceptions about the kids that are coming up, that being digital native and having the skills that they need. I would suggest that maybe rather than being techno-savvy, that the word techno-hockey. I don't know if folks here have been in the classroom or with children at home, but the skills that the kids have oftentimes are more related to entertainment and shopping and so forth rather than solid academic skills. Hence, we see things like in this cartoon, which is in the handout that's in front of you. The teacher has one child read the report about Abraham Lincoln, and the info is all straight and accurate and predictable, and she asks where he got the information, and he says the internet, and the next child steps up to the plate and reads her information about Lincoln having been brought to Earth by aliens, being 7 feet tall with a glass eye, and inventing the electric can opener, and the teacher asks where that information came from, and the response is the internet. which is true. Kids need help navigating the internet, and more importantly, they need to be taught crucial skills to navigate that information source. In secondary grades, we tend to see this scenario where the kids can get really, really involved in a lot of glitz and flash and so forth, but lose sight of the meat and lose sight of the learning piece. It says my term paper has hypertext links, full screen video clips, animated sounds, awesome 3D special effects. Now all I need is a topic. That's where a school like the calculator, the research project calculator from Smitty Candy. A colleague that I had the opportunity to work with, his take on this was the kids are using hammers, but are they building houses? And I would suggest that school libraries can be helpful in directing our kids towards building houses with the tools that we have available. The other issue that we are faced with is digital equity. And that isn't, as many have spoken here about the access to information and technology and library resources in the school environment, we're charged with teaching our students the skills that they need to effectively and efficiently access those information sources, whether it be finding a book in a library or accessing the electronic resources of ELM or the public library. The third issue that is relevant here would be the articulation, the K-20 articulation, that those that ground that the public library starts building with the pre-kindergarten students with reading skills and preparation for the academic environment. We need to build all the way through it, from kindergarten to whatever post-secondary choices kids take on after they graduate from high school. What we ultimately want is for kids to have access to current relevant resources in a variety of formats. That might be print materials, books, magazines, the online encyclopedias, the resources that, again, the ELM or the public library provide. We need them to have guidance and have skills in navigating the research process, instructing in crucial information skills, which would be being able to find, evaluate, and use information ethically, instruction in the use of technical tools, and they need equity in access and in skills. We also want our kids to be independent learners. And I cited this quote from Samuel Johnson, the next best thing to knowing something is knowing where to find it. I think it's appropriate here and speaks to what we want to accomplish. The reality is that good school libraries do all of this. They accomplish all of the things that I've described and more. The data shows that professionally staffed, up-to-date school libraries improve student achievement on an average of 10 to 20%. There's a link there if you want to go and look at the 18-plus studies, one of which was done in Minnesota, to actually see the data. We know there are 3 points here regarding the data from the study that was done in Minnesota by Ms. Smalley and Ms. Baxter. And I don't want to read this out loud for you, so I think I'm just going to leave those and go on to the next point because we're short on time. But it shows that it improves student achievement, the presence of school libraries. And the difficult part to understand in all of this is that Minnesota public schools have reduced or eliminated the school libraries and school library positions in over 375 public schools between 2001 and 2004. They continue. That's the data that we have that's concrete for that period of time. This reduction has continued. I can say from personal experience in St. Paul Public Schools in 2000, 100% of our elementary schools had at least a half-time licensed librarian, library media specialist. This year, only 30% of our elementary schools have licensed librarians or provide access to school libraries for their students. And this is showing up in the middle school and the junior high, levels with kids arriving with no idea at all how to access materials in the library, how to navigate the research process. They don't have a familiarity with ethical use of information, and you know, it just goes on and on. We know that high-achieving suburban schools, private parochial schools, universities and colleges, corporations, hospitals, and museums all have libraries. And yet our schools, our public schools, are not maintaining that resource for our students.
Excuse me, Ms. Steeler. We have to stop right now,
okay.
But Representative Breiling has a question.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Yoder, I noticed, since I am a suburban school representative, your statement about suburban schools, do you have correlations between high-achieving schools and if they have libraries or not?
The data that was done with a school library survey in 2001 and 2003, show that the presence of well-staffed libraries with current collection had an impact on student achievement. And that is in that previous slide that I did not read, but the one that shows more data in Minnesota schools. There are 3 points there. It shows that 93% of the five-star schools in reading and math have library media specialists. And this is related more to staffing, but it would also involve budgets for school libraries and the ability to keep collections current.
Okay, I'm answering President for Ms. Yoder. I would be interested in seeing more of that and to see if, you know, are there rural schools that have libraries and they do better than rural schools that don't and so forth. I see the list you've got here and I recognize how some people like to view suburban schools, but there's such a variety. There's poor suburban schools and others, and I'm just interested in, is there a real good correlation, regardless of where the school is, to achievement, and you know, you just are saying that there kind of is, but I would like to know more than just suburban schools have them, so others should have them too.
According to the data that we have from the national studies and the Minnesota studies, there is a correlation. It's difficult in Minnesota right now because school libraries are endangered, and they are being shut down due to lack of funds.
And what I'm saying, though, Madam Chair, and Ms. Yoder, is it would be more helpful to me as the Chair of Education Finance, a big supporter of libraries, rather than suburb bashing, I'd like some data of, you know, what kind of schools, regardless of location, do they do better due to, and I have taught in St. Paul long ago, so I know there's, you know, differences, but, you know, Robbinsdale isn't a cushy suburban district either. It would be more helpful to support libraries if we could have data on, you know, these rural schools have libraries and they're doing better than these rural schools who aren't, and so forth.
Thank you. And I will see what we can find and follow up with you. And I apologize if that comes across as suburb fashion. I think what I'm trying to do is make points about best practice in situations where resources are available and what some institutions would not consider not having. That was rather than suburb income. We will look at what data we can provide.
But I'll bet they're geographically all the way across the state. Representative Erickson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Greiling, maybe you want to check with the Department of Education and the State Librarian for some of that data, because they may have that, or we could request that they collect that. And I think that's a great idea.
Thank you so much, Ms. Yoder, and the rest of the librarians that came with your enthusiasm and your good information, and it looks, Representative Greiling, Representative Rukavina, that the money was well spent and well received, and you're really enthusiastic over whatever amount you got and whatever you will get in the future, and we appreciate that. It is so, it has such far reaching impact on Minnesotans all the way across the state. And so let's do what we can to keep our libraries open and serving people in their lifelong learning projects. Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair, I would move that the approval of the minutes for Monday, February 25th, 2008.
As printed. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. This meeting is adjourned.